Senator Rosen wants to meet tonight.
We're going to call the Health and Human Services Division to order. We have one change to the agenda that's been handed out. Senator Clausen's Senate File 991 is being pulled from the agenda, so we have Senator Eakin, Senator Hoffman, and then a good deal of the Human Services, the governor's budget proposal regarding the continuing care administration. So with that, Senate File 792, Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I do have an A2 amendment as well to Senate File 792. And this is its first hearing, so I'd offer that just to get it in the shape and form that I would like.
And this is, we have a House fiscal note to reflect the amendment. Is that what I'm to understand? I don't have the A2. Here, it's coming. Oh, that's drafted to the, yeah. It's the two. Okay, we have... Okay, we have the A2. We have a fiscal note drafted to the A2 amendment. Is how what it looks like to me. Is that correct, Senator Eakin?
That would be correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So this is an author's amendment. Senator Eakin moves the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape he wishes to carry it forward. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Eakin on Senate File 792.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And this is a bill for a 5% increase for nursing home facilities and also for the elderly waiver program. And it's with the bill that presented last night is a greatly overdue bill. The long-term care services for seniors has been greatly underfunded over the last several years, and we all want to grow old with dignity and independence and get the care that we need in our senior years. And this bill would do something to get us closer to that goal of ensuring that all seniors are provided with those services. And it's becoming ever more important because of the aging demographics in our state. The boomers are turning 65 at a rate of 10,000 per day across the nation. And by the year 2020, Minnesota will have more seniors than it will school children. So we're facing a real crisis in the area of long-term care for seniors that is a result of this age wave. And if we don't get out in front of this age wave, it's threatening to swamp us and overwhelm a lot of the resources that we need for other things. So this really is an issue that affects more than just care for our seniors and support for those that are caring for them. This really affects our whole state. And senior caregivers are underpaid in our state, very plain and simple. Because so much of senior care funding is controlled by the state, it's up to us to invest in them and the services they provide. There are literally thousands of caregivers working in nursing homes and assisted living centers throughout the state, working to provide good quality care for our loved ones around the clock. And while these individuals would tell you that they do get a great deal of satisfaction out of doing a job that's so important, that's not enough. They obviously need to support themselves and their families as well. And as Minnesota ages, we will need more caregivers and not less. So we need to start investing in caregivers to ensure that we have enough caregivers to take care of our aging population. And the best way to meet the needs and seniors of the caregivers is to invest in our nursing homes and the state's elderly waiver program. As lawmakers, we have put this investment off for far too long. For years, senior care providers have deferred needed investments, particularly in the area of staff wages and benefits, due to state budget cuts and freezes. Senate File 792 is a proposal to partially address these critical funding needs. In my view, this is really a very modest proposal. It is a 5% increase for each of the next 2 years, but that's broken down into a 2% base increase to address the general cost increases for our nursing homes and the elderly waiver program. It's for both staff-related and other costs that have increased since the rates were frozen in 2009. There's also a 2% increase that's available for participation in the Advancing Excellence Program. So the other, 2% for a base increase, 2% for participating in the Advancing Excellence Program. This is a nationwide program that is designed to improve the quality of care for our seniors. And what it does is provide a menu of options available to our nursing homes. And again, this is just for the nursing home facilities. But it provides a variety of options, and the nursing homes would have to choose from that menu. And in order to get that 2% increase, they have to implement two of the things on that menu of options to improve the quality of care. And if they implement one, they get 1%. If they implement the second one, they get that second percent increase. It's very forward-looking. It's not punitive. It's not backward-looking where it punishes nursing homes because they're not meeting up to certain standards or performing up to certain mandates. What it does is it incentivizes nursing homes to improve the quality of care for their residents. There is another 1% increase that's available for investment in critical workforce needs. Uses include here adding staff, reducing the wage gap for caregivers, or addressing growing benefit costs. I think it's important to note also that there is a 73% encumbrance for wages and salaries on the base increase that is proposed in this bill as well. So to ensure that the workers are getting pay increases, which they so desperately need. For the elderly waiver program, this is similarly structured, a 2% base increase to address general cost increases. Again, there's a 73% encumbrance on that for workers. The funds, and then also another 2% of funds to increase, 2% increase for participation in new quality improvement program. This is a competitive program for the elderly waiver that for providers who want to implement new approaches that improve the quality for the clients they serve. There's then a 1% increase, just as with nursing homes again, available for investment in critical workforce needs, including adding staff, reducing the wage gap for caregivers, or addressing growing benefit costs. I believe that supporting our seniors should be one of our highest priorities, and especially given the impending crisis that we are facing if we do not get out in front of this the age wave to ensure, again, that we're providing the quality services that our seniors expect and deserve. And with that, I would like to introduce some testifiers who would like to speak directly to the bill and who can speak personal experience here in working with the senior care providers. And that includes Tom Pollock to my right here from the Park River Estates and Pollock.
Pollock, yep.
Yes, Tom
correct.
Pollock, who would like to testify next.
Mr. Pollock, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Tom Pollock. Administrator of Park River Estates Care Center in Coon Rapids. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. We are a 99-bed nursing home, 14 beds of which are transitional care unit, and the other 85 are for long-term care patients. With me today is John Rewer, CEO of Eventide in Moorhead, Minnesota. John?
Thank you, Tom. Mr. Chair and committee, my pleasure to be here today, and good morning. As president of Eventide, based
Please
in...
state your name for the record one
sorry,
more
John
time.
John Rewer, Eventide, based in Moorhead, Minnesota. We make up, we serve about 1,000 seniors daily, half of those being in the Moorhead side of the river and the other half in a state that has oil wells. We'll get that out of the way right away, but creates some interesting challenges for us. We have a wide variety, as Tom pointed out, of different services ranging from independent living, assisted living, memory care, and, of course, skilled and transitional care. Thank you. Tom?
Thanks, John. Together, we are representing the long-term care imperative. We all agree that supporting our seniors should be one of the highest priorities. We are here today to testify in support for Senate File 792, authored by Senator Eakin. It should be noted that there are two additional bills that accomplish the same thing. In total, 15 senators have authored or co-authored 5% rate increases for long-term care providers. Today, we will present you with information on the crisis in long-term care and lend our support for Senate File 792 that will provide the sorely needed 5% increases in each year for the biennium for long-term care providers.
Moving on to slide two, it's also important to note what an important influence we are in the state workforce. An investment in senior care is about supporting our seniors, but it is also about supporting jobs. Nursing homes and assisted living settings in Minnesota support 114,000 jobs in Minnesota, and I know personally just in our Moorhead community, 500 of those jobs belong to Eventide. If you move on to slide three, we are at a critical point, crisis. In the case of nursing homes, our financial picture has only worsened in the past 4 years. We estimate that 115 out of our 376 nursing homes are at risk of closure, meaning that they have a negative 5% operating margin or worse. As the Board Chair of Aging Services of Minnesota, I have heard firsthand the ways providers have had to deal with these financial challenges. They freeze wages, reduce benefits, reduce hours, close nursing home beds, delay physical plant improvements. None of these are the choices we want to make. The seniors we serve are the ones that bear the burden on these choices. As a mission-driven organization, Eventide strives to provide quality care for the seniors we serve, but our hands are tied by the chronic underfunding of our nursing homes by state lawmakers. And I know that even within our board discussions at Eventide, we talk constantly about where is the critical point where we cannot provide the quality and what is our strategy to exit if we cannot provide that quality with the necessary funding we need.
Thanks, John. For years, senior care providers have deferred needed investments, particularly in the area of staff wages and benefits, due to state budget cuts and freezes. Our proposal will address these critical funding needs. As you can see from this particular slide, slide four, a 2011 long-term care imperative salary survey compared to a 2011 Minnesota Healthcare Cost Information Service hospital salary data survey showed that senior living workers are underpaid in the healthcare market. For an RN, a nursing home can pay $24.57 on average, while a hospital can pay $41.96 per hour, and home care can pay on an average $26.19. The difference between what a nursing home can pay and a hospital can pay is $17.39, or $36,171 per year. I can tell you the reality that happens is that a RN will come to work in a nursing home and stay maybe 6 months to a year and then go for a better paying job at a hospital. Essentially, we're the training grounds for hospitals. And I can tell you personally, at my facility, we currently have 6 open positions for RNs. For LPNs, there is also a gap between what a nursing home can pay at $18.23 versus $20.30 per hour at the hospital for $4,306 per year. In nursing assistants, the differential between what a nursing home can pay and a hospital can pay is $5.79 per hour or $12,043 per year. This chart does not account for what we hear anecdotally across the state. Our nursing homes and housing with services settings report that we lose staff to other industries, such as home improvement store opening in a rural community that can pay more per hour, offer better hours and discounts, and less emotionally challenging work. We also have situations in southwest Minnesota where there are ads in the newspapers to pay hog handlers more than we can pay nursing assistants who care for our most vulnerable people in our state. The next slide for regarding the direct care staff shortages shows that we are in the long-term care profession are faced with great staffing shortages. Long-term care providers actually benefit in an economic downturn and see more shortages as the economy improves. In 2012, the direct care positions currently exceed 1,600 positions. I can tell you specifically in my facility from 2009 through 2011, we had an average of 7 people leave for better paying jobs. In 2012, it was 35. The next slide, it shows that the rates for people who receive care and housing with services, assisted living, or other home care settings have actually declined 17.85% since 2009, with another 1.67% cut scheduled to take effect on July 1st, 2013. Nursing home rates have not received an across-the-board rate increase since before 2009. With that said, in 2011, there were 70 low-rate facilities that received very small increases, and in 2012, 7 nursing homes were designated as critical access and received small rate increases. To put this into context, however, because of the rate equalization law in Minnesota, the state legislature controls, on average, 82% of our funding that nursing homes receive. Our costs for fuel, electricity, supplies, food, etc., have all gone up, at least at inflation rate, and during the past 4 years, it's at least 6.5%. Our caregivers are the most, in most cases, have gone without raises in 4 years. One additional point on this is that there are 372 nursing homes in the state. The next, as far as the next slide, slide 7, as a whole state, Minnesota has the 9th highest gap in 37 states in the year 2010. The Minnesota Medicaid program reimburses nursing homes $27.70 per resident day below allowable costs. The U.S. average is $22.34 per day, and North Dakota actually reimburses above the allowable Medicaid rate by $2.86 per day. I mention North Dakota only because they are the only other state that has rate equalization, and as you can see, they pay appropriately. John?
Thank you. Slide 8 also covers a very, very important part of our service to seniors, and that's our elderly waivered services. The state's elderly waiver program is the program that pays for services in the assisted living settings and home care settings. It is as critical to our senior care infrastructure as nursing homes. This program is designed to serve seniors in a most cost-effective way and keep seniors out of nursing homes. However, current funding levels do not cover the actual cost of care provided. This puts providers in a tough position of either providing uncompensated care, cost shifting onto private paying seniors, or limiting our participation in the program. And I can tell you that at Eventide, we probably have a combination of all three of those things going to make that program work for our community. Moving on to slides 9 and 10, I think it's important to note also that our spending in long-term care is decreasing and coming in under forecast. Both slides 9 and 10 show that nursing home spending and EW spending are declining and routinely are coming in under the forecast. In the case of EW, the reduction in spending is a direct reflection of the double-digit cuts imposed in the past 4 years. While spending in this program has declined, caseload has actually grown, meaning we are serving more seniors with fewer dollars. In conclusion, Mr. Chair and committee, we want to thank also Senator, I was so adamant I was not going to make that mistake, Senator Eakin, for his continued leadership and support for investments in seniors and their caregivers. We know this commitment faces a difficult budget target. However, this is an area that we have neglected for far too long. Our seniors and caregivers deserve more, and Senator Eakin's bill is a step in the right direction. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know there was one other testifier that was going to be here, but she wasn't able to make it because of the weather. So,
okay.
With that, I guess we'll stand for any questions.
Any questions of members? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Pollack, on the first slide where you have the state and it's all breaking off.
Senator Rosen, I see you're onto that slide. There, we got two versions of this handout. Mm-hmm. And let me just say the one, I spent some time looking at it. The color one is from March, and that would have been using the 2011 nursing facility financial survey. The one that's not color, that's black and white, is an updated one.
If you want
the more updated numbers, and they actually changed quite significantly by region, I mm-hmm. noted. And so the slide that they stepped us through is the black and white slide for members. I don't know how, we were sent two copies of this, I guess, one updated.
Right, because Mr. Chair, on the color one from the March is 85 nursing homes, and now the current information is 115 nursing homes are facing financial crisis and a loss of 15,000 jobs. My question, Mr. Pollack, is the nursing homes that are facing financial crisis. Well, let me rephrase that. Are there facilities out there that are doing everything possible to not be listed as one of the 115 nursing facilities, such as not providing health insurance? I mean, the list can go. I know in my district they've taken all sorts of measures to make sure that they stay in the black and they aren't one that's listed as a financial crisis nursing facility. Can you explain what they're doing to stay afloat is basically
Mr.
what
Pollack.
I'm asking.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen. What you end up doing is you whether you're increasing deductibles and or even just the costs, we provide health care coverage, but the cost per month is so prohibitive that actually some of the staff members go on Minnesota Care because it's too costly. When I mentioned about, you know, when you're not giving raises and you have people who have the experience and they go elsewhere to the hospital, for instance, with my 35 people that left in 2012, you hire at a lower wage. I mean, the starting wage, I should say. That adds up. Some of the perks that you might have done in the past, be it, you know, something to boost morale, you eliminate those. But you really start looking at what do we need to do to really eliminate the benefits that you'd rather have people there. If you have to eliminate some holidays, personal days, increase the eligibility for benefits is another way to do it. And some just say, you know what, my spouse and I just want to start a family, so I'm going to go to the hospital and make $3 more an hour. But it's very critical. And my mother has been at my facility three times, and it was very important for her to have the same caregiver every day. Well, if you have 35 caregivers leave in a year, she's not going to get that.
And, Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Pollack, you did mention that, too. That caught my attention. In 2012, you lost 35. And I was just wondering if there was, again, you know, one issue, or is it just the culmination of all the years, no increases, the threat of no insurance or what's going to happen? I mean, is there anything else that is driving that significant from 7 to 35, you said?
Mr. Pollack.
Thank you, Ms. Chair and Senator Rosen. We absolutely love a recession. In a recession, there are no jobs. Everybody is afraid to leave a job because they can't find one. And we are the first ones to say we dread the day when the economy turns around. So for 2009, 10, and 11, when you have 7 people leave each year, for a total of 21, and then the economy turns around, hospitals are hiring, other businesses are hiring, higher than what we can pay, they're gone.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I know there's other questions from the committee, and we probably could delve into the quality improvement portion of this bill, but I just want to say that this is, you know how you walk around these halls and you think you kind of have a running tally in your head of things that are a priority in your mind? This is absolutely a tremendous crisis that we're addressing right now. And I know we're under some pressures, budgetary pressures, but this is and should be a huge priority for this entire body, because these folks cannot sustain, and this industry cannot sustain any more pressure. Otherwise, we have to redo the entire funding mechanism for it and give the people that work there what they deserve to be paid. I think it's almost shameful, you know, from the testimony last night, Senator Eakin's bill from last night and today. And I've worked very hard in this issue. I serve about 14 different nursing facilities, and it just comes down to an infusion of dollars. That's basically what's going to help this industry, because we have worked on so many other angles to help support this industry. And really, when it comes down to it, it is just basically being able to retain and keep this quality workforce there so they can provide the care to our vulnerable. And that's flat out the issue. So I think this should be a number one priority for this committee.
Madam Chair.
Senator Egan.
Oh, and Madam Chair, and I just want to thank Senator Rosen for her work on this as well. I think it's important to note that this was a bipartisan effort. She is the second co-author on this bill and has been working in a bipartisan group. We've put this together bipartisanly because we see that this is an issue that cuts across party lines. It's a crisis that needs to be addressed. No matter what party you're from, we need to address it. So, and thank you for your help on that, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Senator Egan, for your work, too.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Would you tell me your name again? I'm sorry.
John Rewer, Senator.
And
Tom.
Thank you.
And Tom Pollack.
My question for you is about the quality, the breakdown in the reimbursement of the 5%. There's 78 or 76%, I can't remember the formula, of the first 2% that is directed towards employee wages and then 2% that's a quality initiative. The first question I have is, you know, there's just very little question in people's minds that this is an industry that is in crisis and that we have been unable or unwilling to make commitments to help support this system. In this proposal, we're doing some things about the obvious message that you've given us that you aren't able to pay your employees adequately in order to keep them. So I suspect that the components of this that say you need to use some of this increase to improve the quality of the payment to your employees isn't problematic to you because you know you need to do that in order to keep the consistency of your staff. But I think we have really tightened things down so that it's difficult. We have failing systems, people that are at risk, or nursing homes that are at risk. So... And I believe in quality improvement, but when we start directing you in that way, it's a lot of expectations to accomplish quality initiatives, to reduce the complaints that come from people about maltreatment, to increase your fees to cover maltreatment investigations. You know, there's just demand on improved quality, and yet we aren't providing the resources. So. What is your reaction to the portion of the 5% being aligned with quality initiatives?
Mr. Reber?
Let me start. Well, first of all, thank you. It's a great question. And I think just about any provider across the state would tell you it's all about quality, every bit of this. But they would also tell you that, you know, as desperate as we are to get anything right now, in some ways this may be too little too late, even for many. And so it's hard to get to that quality if you're starting at a disadvantage already in terms of what you need to do with staffing and what you need to do to compete against the hog farmers and everybody else for employees. So I would tell you that there's some providers that would still look at this and go, I don't know how I'm going to achieve the next step with that extra percent or two that's tied to that. That said, we're in desperate times. And so from my perspective, we're looking at how we keep the infrastructure together. Maybe there's better days ahead. Maybe there's some other things that we can do down the road. But the very people that are in crisis are the people that the state is going to look to create those options, create those opportunities, and deal with this bubble of a demographic that's coming down the road.
And just to follow up, my question is setting you up to fail, setting you up to fail. I know that that's not what Senator Egan is trying to do here at all, but just conceptually, So I want to make sure I'm hearing you correctly. The people are desperate for the money, so you're less likely to come in here and say, hey, you know, we cannot get this other 2% because we're just what we need is to just keep our employees in place or to try to sustain consistency in our staff, and we're operating below what it costs us to run a da-da-da-da. So I want to know if we're setting up a system here that will make it difficult for you to really get that other 2% because you just don't have enough oomph in the system to get to one or two of those menu of changes that are being suggested for that 2%.
My perception would be that for many it will be a challenge to get there, even with that, even with the increase.
And Adam Chair and
Senator Eakin?
Senator Sharon, I have the same concerns, and understanding the desperate situations many nursing homes are facing, as you said, to add on more to burdens when they're just trying to stay alive and to keep moving forward. That's one of the reasons that, you know, we feel we need to look for efficiencies, but the Advancing Excellence program is not punitive in nature, and that's one of the good things about it. I understand there's still concerns to be had. I think they're legitimate concerns, but it does not look backward and penalize nursing homes for not meeting up to, you know, the criteria or the standards of this Advancing Excellence program. It's more of a carrot than a stick. My hope is that, you know, all the nursing homes would be able to find two things on those menus of options that they would be able to implement that would, in the long run, improve the quality of care and increase efficiency, hopefully. But I do think you raise a legitimate concern that needs to be looked at and considered as we move forward here.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Senator Eakin, and thank you for I am concerned about this. I believe in the quality improvement process, but when we, on the one hand, demand the quality, but we don't provide the resources to even keep the place open, you know, I don't like double binds like that. And so I think at a minimum we should do an analysis of how many of the nursing homes were able to achieve and try to get a sense. I'm not wanting to write that in the legislation and get a fiscal note or something, but I really want to take a look at how this played out in terms of the real lives of the real businesses that are trying to serve the elderly people after this biennium. So,
Mr. Chair, I would agree with that. I would, you know, in favor of that as well. And you know, and I think one of the reasons, of course, that we put it things like this in the legislation is to also garner more support for additional funding as well. And that's one of the reasons that this was done, because we do want to get this 5%. And if it takes, you know, putting into place this Advancing Excellence program, that's maybe a good way to get there. But we do have to make sure we don't put the nursing homes in a bind where they won't be able to secure those 2%.
Yeah, and just to be clear, what we get into is... thank you, Senator Laurie. I'm sorry. That when I say review this, I don't mean, did you meet this? What did you do to meet this quality initiative? I mean the question of whether or not we created an untenable situation for nursing homes to achieve the quality, the 2% around the quality, not to evaluate whether or not they did well. That's not what I'm meaning when I say go back and take a look at the implications of this language. But I appreciate your putting together a package that gets support and what you have to do sometimes to do that. So thank you.
Senator Rosen?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, it would be, well, of course, I would like to hear the department, Mr. Held's description of the Advancing Excellence and how that's come about. And I'd like to know if there has been participation from the industry on these quality measures and if there will be going forward. I think that's important. And actually, I don't think it's a bad thing to ask for accountability measures when there is state dollars involved. And I think that's our responsibility to ask for improvement in our quality. Not saying that that is... you know, I think sometimes one bad apple taints the entire barrel, but there are some very, very, very good facilities out there. 99% of them are. So we have to be careful not to penalize all the rest of them. But I think what I'm trying to say is that we should have full participation in this Advancing Excellence and make sure it works for everybody and not in a penalizing type of modality. And and expect results for this type of investment going forward.
Senator Kiffmeyer?
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple questions. One of them is that I've heard from nursing homes before is sometimes the regulations and mandates that some of the paperwork, bureaucracy, things like that cost you money and take away from direct nursing care. My question for you is, are there mandates, regulations, paperwork that maybe don't, you know, that have outlived their usefulness that could be lifted for you that would maybe help to take away something if we're going to, because sometimes those things can be helpful as well in the whole effort that you give to care for people.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think if this conversation were being held in D.C. instead of St. Paul, we'd get a lot more traction with this, and that's really one of the issues we have is so much of that. So the answer to your question is yes. There's a tremendous amount of it that's archaic and not necessary, but it's also federally required, so it's difficult at the state level to have many of those changes. But I would always be, I think our memberships are both open to anything that could be done to streamline and create efficiencies within our systems. And so from that end of things, like I said, so much of it's federal, and I appreciate the question. And as we develop anything that folks here in St. Paul can help us with, we'll be back to talk about it.
Thank you. Senator Kiffmeyer, you said you had a couple of questions, another?
I did, but the gentleman also had a...
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, to illustrate one of the federal regulations that state surveyors look at when they come in, we're required to post our staffing levels each day according to census. And it's by shift, RN, LPN, CNA, TMA. That's been in effect for, I believe, about 8-9 years. 6 years ago in November, I decided to put on the bottom of the sheet, "Dear public, if you read this, please see Tom for $10. To date, I have yet to give out $10, and we average 50 to 55 people visiting our facility every single day. So take 55 times 365 times 6. That's one of those that you can get cited on if it's not posted, and it's a federal requirement. So as John said, it's on a federal level, yes, but... So please don't come in my facility and ask you for the $10, because now you know what I have on there.
Let me do say, though, that we are the finance division of the state of Minnesota, and, you know, we have a long agenda to get through. And so I would appreciate it if members and testifiers could stick to what's in this bill so that we can proceed, and with all due respect for the difficult situation that you do find yourselves in, and it has been a good conversation, and I don't mean to be tamping it down. But with that, Senator Kiffmeyer, you had another question as well?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any other questions of members? Seeing none, Senator Rosen, did you have another question?
Well, I did have a question. I'm not sure if the department wanted to talk about their quality measures to them.
Sure. Is there somebody from the department that could come?
Mr. Held should be here. I thought I saw him.
Yeah. Mr. Held, welcome to the committee. Did you have a specific question? Or?
Well, I'd like to know, Mr. Chair, about the advancing excellence, and I think that's a very big part of this bill.
Mr. Held, could you give us some of the department's perspective on the advancing excellence?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, I'm Bob Held from the Department of Human Services. Advancing Excellence is a national program. It's sponsored by CMS and a number of other organizations, including trade associations that represent nursing homes. They have approximately 9 goals that they have set. Participation is voluntary. A facility that chooses to participate can choose 2 of those goals or more. And the Advancing Excellence tool website provides them some excellent resources on how to work toward achieving quality improvement with those goals. The latest data that has been shared with me is that about 60% of Minnesota nursing homes are already participating in Advancing Excellence. We are now slightly above the national average for participation. The language in this bill would require facilities to get the initial year's 2% rate increase to simply sign on to advancing excellence, select goals, and as I understand it, declare that they're really going to work hard on this. The language then requires for them to get the 2% increase in the second year to have demonstrated sustained improvement.
Measured by
Mr. Rosen?
Mr. Chair, measured by what, Mr. Held?
Mr. Held?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, if I heard you correctly, you asked measured by what. It doesn't
yes.
really say. We understand it to mean improvement related to the goals they selected.
Okay. And Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Held, has the industry stakeholders, have they been involved in crafting this and making sure that it is doable for the other 40% that are not achieving some part of advancing excellence?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, this was an initiative that came from the long-term care imperative and from other stakeholder groups that were part of a coalition, so I'm assuming they consulted themselves.
Does the department feel that you have what you need to measure those goals, or did you need more specificity, I think, was part of the question?
Mr. Chair, it's hard for us to exactly conceptualize how, on a timely basis, for the second year, we would be able to determine that sustained improvement had occurred. It would probably be helpful to tell us what is meant by sustained. We typically think of that as being for a period of, you know, years and not necessarily days or weeks. But we would need to make determinations and provide rate notices at least 6 weeks prior to when that goes into effect. And what that means is that there's actually less than a year for a facility to be getting, or approximately a year, for a facility to be getting signed up on advancing excellence, select their goals, actually do some work on it, achieve some improvement, and then sustain that improvement. So I think that aspect of the language might need a little bit of work. I don't think that's an undoable task, but I think it needs to be explored a little bit.
When I hear you describe that, it sounds more like sustainable than sustained. I mean, sustained is looking backwards and having seen it actually integrated. Sustainable would be a determination that they've actually integrated some of these changes into what they're doing, and it looks like they're going to be able to maintain them into the future. I mean, I don't know, but and I'm not suggesting that we make that change right at this moment, but that's kind of what I hear. Senator Rosen? Did you have further questions? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Heidi Holste. I'm with Care Providers of Minnesota representing the Long-Term Care Imperative. I just wanted to offer one clarification, that is the Advancing Excellence Advancing Excellence language in this bill was put forward by the coalition that that supports this bill, including the Long-Term Care Imperative, AARP, and the unions that are part of this coalition. And it is a forward-looking approach. The department's approach or the governor's approach in their language is looking at the report card. And we looked at this and said, to improve quality, we feel that the funding is necessary on the front end rather than looking backward. So just wanted to offer that clarification.
Thank you, Ms. Holste. Any other questions of members? Seeing none, anyone? Senator Sharon.
Well, I heard you say, and I agree, that we should look at that one term, sustained. And I wonder when we would be able to do that. We'll still have an opportunity to take a look at whether or not that word ought to remain in there, because it's without it, it just says and demonstrated improvement. Then in the next biennium, we can maybe talk about sustainability. But I don't want to set this up so that the department doesn't know what sustained means. They get into an argument about whether or not the improvement really reflects a sustained improvement, and then the nursing homes are penalized. So I think that we're in just a two-year time frame here. We ought not set it up in a way that it's just almost impossible for them to receive the other 2%. That's my concern. So I don't know when to do that.
Senator Eakin, do you feel that's a change we could get through and get to a decent place?
Mr. Chair, yes, I would support such a change at this point.
Senator
so
Sharon.
I would make that this term. I was looking for it. I see it's on line 1.20. It may be repeated under the waiver, and I just haven't found it there. But where it refers to it would remain then. I would recommend that the language simply say demonstrated improvement in this 2-year biennium. That's not defined either, but I think that's a lower requirement than a sustained improvement.
So Senator Sharon moves that on Senate on line 1.20, remove the word sustained.
Correct. And is that language also included in the quality improvement language for the waiver program? I just cannot find 1% who just work for managed care.
I can't find it either.
And then, okay, so it's not there. So that's the only place that it will be in the bill.
And, Mr. Chair, I do support that. Again, the goal here is not to penalize, but to make sure that they all – the hope is that they're all going to be getting this additional 2% because they'll all be able to move in this direction towards, improved quality. So,
Mr. Held, does that help provide some of the clarity as to how the department would approach evaluating whether the targets had been met?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think the removal of the word sustained would make it more clear what happens on the second year, yes.
Okay. On Senator Sharon's motion, any questions, further comments? Seeing none. On Senator Sharon's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Any other further discussion of members? Seeing none, anyone from the audience care to speak either in support or in opposition to Senate File 792? Ms. George,
Mr. Chair,
welcome to the committee.
Mary Jo George with ARP. Thank you. I wasn't going to testify, but I do want to just say for the record, we are working with the long-term care imperative. We are still researching Advancing Excellence Program. We have come up with a list of areas that we think we need to discuss, including transparency. At this point, we don't believe there is transparency in reporting the goals. So I've talked to Senator Eakin, and we'd like to work with the imperative on that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. Any further testimony from the audience? Seeing none, Senator Eakin moves that Senate File 792, as amended, be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Hoffman. Senate File 553, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you again as well. Always a pleasure.
Real quick, this bill that is in front of you repeals the existing 1.67% payment rate decrease that was for the intermediate care facilities developmental disability programs, operating payment rates, provider payment rates, home and community-based services, waivers, personal care attendants, and private duty nursing, as well as the alternative care folks. The 1.67% decrease is scheduled to be enacted on July 1st, 2013, and expire. It's a six-month decrease that was used to balance the budget 2 years ago or last year. And unfortunately, that is on the backs of people with disabilities. And so this is basically repealing that and putting those services back that are most needed in ACT. And in front of you should also have the fiscal note as well as the House has laid this into the omnibus bill. So I stand for questions.
We
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'm sorry. There is an amendment, an author's amendment. I should have somebody move if I can. It's just basically page 1, line 8. It deletes subdivision 12 and inserts subdivision. And council research, Dave can answer questions on that. It was just a slight overlook.
Okay. This would be a author's amendment. Senator Sharon moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And then the reason, okay, so both the Senate and the House fiscal note have the same numbers. I don't quite. The House reflects the bill incorporating this amendment. So with that clarification, any questions of members? I think we've all talked about this for quite some time, so understand it well. Any further comments, Senator Hoffman?
No. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone from the audience care to speak either in support or in opposition? Oh, you have a testifier. Would you like to testify?
I'm just here for questions.
Okay. Anyone in the audience care to speak either in favor or in support of Senate File 553?
Clear that the amendments are supposed to be tomorrow.
Okay. Seeing none, Senator Sharon? Moves Senate File 553 as amended be recommended to pass and laid on the table for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, Senator and members, thank you very much. Have a good snowy day.
A nice little farewell to winter.
I missed my egg.
Yes.
It was like horrible.
Okay. And so now, with that, we're going to move to Senate File 1034 again.
See what? I mean, it should be for Monday. Okay, because I told you.
Okay.
Senator Lori.
Chair, I think we're going to start with the ombudspersons for family, if they're still. Yeah, I know they were here. And folks. Well, maybe somebody can find them. We also have the Disability Council. I see Joan Wilshire is here. And then, because otherwise everybody has to wait for a long time to get through the continuing care article, so.
Ms. Wilshire, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Joan Wilshire. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Council on Disability, and we'd like to thank you for inviting us in to do a little presentation on the council and the governor's recommendation proposal on our continuation of emergency preparedness planning. The Council on Disability was created in 1973, and we are now celebrating our 40th anniversary this year, so we're rather excited about that. We exist as an advisory agency to the governor, state legislature, state agency, and the public regarding disability issues. I basically report to a 21-member council board. We will be looking to change that down to 17. There is a bill going through on that. And I have 7 staff, 5 full-time, 2 permanent. In terms of issue areas that we work on in generality here, the ADA program access issues is a big area for us. We help to keep the state in compliance regarding the ADA. Building code and accessibility, another huge area for us, working with the Twin Stadium, making it one of the nationally known accessible stadiums. And, of course, we'll be doing the same for the Viking Stadium as that starts to get built. Disability parking, emergency preparedness, employment and transportation policy, and human and civil rights are among the other areas that we work on. Overall, we probably in an annual year get over 17,000 contacts. That includes emails, telephone calls, presentations, trainings, going to conferences, and et cetera. So we're a busy little agency. How we do this outreach at the council, town hall meetings, our annual legislative forum, ADA celebration, July 26th every year, annual awards recognition event in the fall. We host an event where employers are recognized for hiring people with disabilities, and, of course, Advocacy Day. That was to be today. That is canceled because of the lovely springtime weather we are having. So we'll have one another 2 weeks.
Cross that off my calendar.
You can cross that off your calendar. Unless you'd like to, just for exercise, go to the rotunda and holler at noon in support of our issues. That still would be appreciated. Another big outreach area is our Minnesota State Fair booth at the Education Area Building. Many of you, I'm sure, have been by. We have an outreach there of over 5,000 people. That people loved coming, getting all our materials and so forth. So that is a huge area in terms of working on our outreach. Now, that kind of just is a brief overview of what it is we do as an agency, and now I'd like to move into the area of the governor's recommendations of our funding for continued coordinated emergency preparedness activities addressing the needs of people with disabilities. This basically is looking to accomplish with this increase of appropriation of $90,000 to the State Council on Disability is needed to really fund one FTE to build on the existing strong partnerships that we have. We most specifically work with Homeland Security and the Department of Health, along with some other agencies. The rationale why we're looking at this increase and the governor is recommending it is that Minnesotans with disabilities experience adverse impact during emergencies compared to non-disabled Minnesotans. Now, with me today is our senior staff person at the council, Margot Indick Cross. She's our accessibility specialist and has been with us for over 25 years, and she is the person that has really developed this program and can really speak to what we will be doing with this additional funds.
Good morning. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Margot Imdick Cross. I'm the accessibility specialist with the Minnesota State Council on Disability. And I'm just going to very briefly talk to you about what the position would entail. Okay. After 9/11, there was heightened concern and awareness about the evacuation of people with disabilities. The vast majority of people with disabilities who worked in the Twin Towers perished with 9/11 because there was no adequate emergency egress plan in place for a lot of folks with disabilities at that time. Subsequently, the president, then President Bush, ordered that the federal government work with the state government, local government, tribal governments, and nonprofits and other organizations to address the safety concerns of individuals with disabilities. Counties and cities throughout Minnesota are working, have worked, and are working on their emergency plans for their communities. But despite their best efforts, communities need information and training on how to address the concerns of people with disabilities in their community. And when we talk about those issues, we're talking about notification, we're talking about communicating an emergency to an individual with a hearing impairment or somebody who's deaf. We're talking about mass evacuation of people with disabilities, with mobility impairments. We're talking about sheltering and how accessible is the shelter? Has anybody, gone in and done an assessment to determine whether or not it would accommodate seniors and people with disabilities with grab bars and raised toilets? And if you choose a shelter that's not accessible, you're gonna create an additional problem. And with that, support services. It's been traditionally it has been that people with disabilities were sent off to a special needs shelter, and we're fighting real hard in the state of Minnesota to make sure that shelters are integrated so that I can rely on my family, I can rely on my husband, I can rely on my neighbors, people I know, people I trust, and it doesn't add an extra burden to the system. We don't have to bring in PCAs. We don't have to bring in nursing staff. So we're really working hard on developing natural support systems. According to the U.S. Census, 1 in 20 persons, 20% of the population has a disability. That's 1 in 5. If you're over the age of 65, that number rises dramatically to over 50%.
So again, when we talk about people with disabilities, we automatically bring in the senior community because they benefit from the vast majority of accessibility features that we today are working for. So we are working with a lot of different partners. As Joan indicated, we are working with a number of different agencies. The whole mentality in the nation is going to, you know, being prepared. We're going to just skip right over that because I've heard you're in a bit of a rush this morning. But do ask questions if you want. What we have to do and what we want to increase with this position is we want to conduct more training. People with disabilities need training on how to prepare themselves. First responders need training. Emergency management personnel at counties and city levels need training. A lot of people are really uncertain on how to proceed. If you have a disability in a disaster, what's going to be the next step? And then we partner with other agencies to develop policy. And again, we're talking about notification, access to transportation, accessible shelters, personal care and personal support systems, access to communication, making sure people have adequate medical supplies and that the typical cash for a shelter has everything that I might need, or at least some of what I might need, in that type of displacement, assistive technology, and service and companion animals. Our partners, and Joan's going to finish up.
Right. With you, you've seen our main brochure. The front and last page are on water-resistant paper, so you can drop it outside on a lovely light day like today and still have a product that you can use. And this is for or with or without people with disabilities. It's a fantastic brochure. We have a lot of them. We have partnered with Homeland Security. We received $60,000 last year to purchase more of these. Our bags we give out at the state fair. And so we've got the products that we just need training and time right now. And this is our book on employers and training. We do that as well. So we are all set to go, but we need basically funding for a full-time person to do this because we've just been doing this amongst all our other things that we've been doing. And then just to wrap it up, because of our expertise, we do a lot of training. We did our last conference was in 2005. We're hoping to do another one. And just yesterday, we conducted training at a national conference for farmers and ranchers. And we're asked to go now to the National ADA Symposium in May in Texas to give this same type of presentation as well. So we're just looking for your support on the governor's recommendation here. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wilshire. Senator Eakin or members, do you have any questions? I think we're waiting for the budget pages on this section. Okay. We're getting copies at this point to share with the members. Seeing no questions, should we proceed to the next area?
Yes. Thank you. And we will get those budget pages. I thought I had them, but it didn't extend quite that far. So we'll get those and hand them out and hear from the ombudspersons for families.
Ready? Do you have anything on?
Stuck my face in that light twice.
We didn't.
Here's
copies for them.
Okay, another handout.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Dawn Blanchard. I am the ombudsperson for American Indian Families. And with me today is my colleague. I'll let her introduce herself.
My name is Bao Ning Chu, and I am the ombudsperson for Asian Families.
Thank you for being here. Please proceed with your testimony.
I have just handed out a quick fast facts form for about the office. The office was created in 1991 from the four communities of color, American Indian, Spanish-speaking, Asian, and African-American groups. These community members were concerned about transparency in the child protection system, making sure these families were adequately served and with the appearance at that time of possible discrimination in the system towards these families, this office was developed to answer disparities in the child protection system. Our office provides services that no other agency in the state provide. We help these families when usually they are in crisis. They are in the child protection system. The children are placed out of home, and they usually feel that the system isn't answering their questions or providing them services that they think would really help them move along and hopefully get their children returned to them. Regarding what we are talking about today, under the governor's recommendation, we have the recommendation of one FTE for the office for an office manager. At this point, the office has always been funded at four FTEs, so there's only the four of us. We have no investigators. We have no clerical help. It's just us. We have had an office manager in the past, but because of budget constraints and our budget getting whittled down as things go, as time goes on, we had to let the office manager position go after she took medical leave, and we haven't filled it. At this point, we're working without any clerical help. The ombudspersons each take turns each biennium to do the finances for the office, creating the budget, paying the bills, all that kind of stuff. At this point, that's now me for this biennium, and the other ombudspersons will be taking turns as time goes on if we do not get an office manager. It takes away from our regular duties of serving these constituents who are in crisis in the child protection system, where kids are floundering in the system, and the constituents feel that, they're not getting the services they need. In a nutshell, our grant total of calls into the office just in 2012 was 946. Of those 946, 156 of these cases were resolved informally, and 16 had a formal investigation taken. At this point, I'm open for questions.
Members, any questions? Seeing none, is your colleague also testifying?
It's here for questions if there's anything specific on the Asian community that you have questions about.
And I think members have the budget pages now for this section. Questions, I think we can proceed ahead.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Okay, so then microphone here. We'll get going on the continuing care articles from the governor's budget proposal. And welcome back to the committee, Lauren Coleman, who can step us through. And we have another one of these Health and Human Services indexes that will step us through the governor's budget pages, referencing the article and section number in the big bill if members want to see the actual language. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Coleman.
Welcome back. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Lauren Coleman, Assistant Commissioner for Continuing Care at the Department of Human Services. As you may recall, we were here a few weeks ago and walked through the continuing care proposals from the governor's budget. There is one proposal that I know you're familiar with, but has been added to the governor's proposal that I'll address also. And then move through the other elements and answer any questions you may have about the proposals. The one addition to the governor's budget is the buyback of the 1.67% long-term care reduction. Again, I think you're familiar with it, and in the interest of time, I think I don't need to describe how we got to where we are, but it is a temporary rate reduction for 6 months that is being recommended to not be implemented.
And that's already on the table for possible consideration. So.
Right.
Yep.
Moving on, and I'm going to work off of the index sheet that Senator Lurie referenced. The next item that I'll mention is a collection of ideas that we refer to as Reform 2020. And again, as we've talked in the past, we are proposing a series of reforms to our long-term care system and supports that prepare us better into the future for the demographic pressures that have already been mentioned here today, as well as the changes that older Minnesotans and people with disabilities are looking for to become more involved in their care. The first is enhancing the vulnerable adult protection system. As we have evolved over the last number of years to a more dispersed system, less institutional care, most of our individuals that we're serving, most older Minnesotans and people with disabilities, are living in the community. They're living in their homes, apartments, other settings. And so this is to adjust how we are collectively managing that the protection of those populations. First, we are proposing a statewide common entry point telephone call system where all Minnesotans who are observing or suspecting maltreatment or people at risk would have a well-known mechanism with which to report that. Today, it's quite confusing to know which agency to report to, the county, the state, business hours, off hours, et cetera. So this would be a 24/7 telephone line that people could call. We then, at the state, would then determine which is the appropriate agency to conduct the investigation so that we can speed up the investigation if someone is at risk and make sure that we're not confusing people as to where to report suspicious maltreatment. We also are recommending within this budget resources for the counties to do their role in adult protection. And because we still rely substantially on local government to be our eyes and ears and monitors and investigators at that local level, we think that's still important. So you would have the three agencies, be it DHS, MDH, counties, who would all be assigned their appropriate case, if you will, to follow up on. We think it's an adjustment that is needed not only for today in recognizing our dispersed system, but also as we grow into the future. The next item is budget page number 22, Alternative Care and Essential Community Supports. This has been talked about before. Basically, what we're doing here is we are working with the federal government to have them assist us in supporting these community-based programs. We strongly believe that these are saving Medicaid dollars by keeping people in their homes and out of the Medicaid program with a lower cost support, and that the federal government should participate with us as part of our overall spectrum of services, our continuum of services. We've had conversations with CMS. They have not given us an affirmative answer, but they haven't said no yet either. So we do believe that this is an important part of reforming our system. Again, I'm not going to comment on each and every item on the list in interest of time, but certainly are willing to answer questions if there are any. The next one I'd like to highlight is the first contact, budget page number 26. Again, this is part of reforming the system of how we interact with people in our programs. There's a couple key mentions on this. One, Streamlining the pre-admission screening. When do we first come in contact with people needing our long-term care system? So this would change the mechanism of how we're doing that, and we would use our linkage lines and our area agencies on aging to do some of the more first level of screening to see if people need supports from the state or from local communities. It expands the return to community program, which has been very successful in working with individuals who are in nursing facilities who express a desire to return home. The program has targeted initially, and I use the word targetedly, not in a negative connotation, but we focused on private paying individuals who wish to move home, but need some additional support in which to accomplish that goal. So this would expand it to other populations. It would expand it to people who are living in assisted living, who may wish to return to a different living environment. And again, it is a proven strategy that is saving the state money as well as helping people meet their own personal goals. Part of this proposal also invests in a home and community-based report card. Similar but not identical to the nursing home report card, where consumers, families, others can look at a report card, how a particular home community-based provider is performing, with which to have more information to make an informed decision about what services they wish to purchase. It has not been developed yet, although there's many groups that have been working on what a report card could look like. But this is development work, and we would commit to work with stakeholders, both on the aging side as well as the disability side, to find out and determine what is most useful to consumers, families, others, in which to make a good decision. We also want to have an evaluation of these services and use it as part of our quality improvement. And so when I get to a little further on, you'll see how it connects with some of our rate changes that we're proposing.
Senator Sharon.
We have a question for Senator Laurie. If there are amendments to be made to any of the components of the, as we're going through it, when would you like those to be presented?
Senator Laurie?
Organizationally, ideally, I would like to try to get through with this yet this morning. I don't know how we're going to quite do that. I know we have 8 testifiers signed up who would like to offer testimony. I know we had that one amendment that was offered already and then withdrawn, the A8. We had some testimony on that one already. I'd like to try to let the department get through with their presentation and then open it up for the testimony and then see how many amendments we have and try to get through this yet this morning.
Thank you.
That'd be my desire.
For sure.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll move on. And I think the next one
no,
I would like...
Before we move on, let me just say also, this isn't our last shot at this. We're going to have a delete everything, that'll be rolled out on Monday. It'll include some of this. It won't include some of this. And I will try to give people as much lead time as they can and have another round of amendments Monday and Tuesday of next week, and we can take another stab at this. And I really want to be open and accountable on this. And what we're doing here is trying to get things on the table. So I want to facilitate a really good discussion. But if don't feel like if we don't get an amendment adopted, we're just ignoring it, and this is our last shot at it. I want to make sure that people understand that.
Mr. Coleman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to highlight budget page number 35, the Community First Services and Supports. It is one of those, although they are all important, this is one that has received a tremendous amount of work. There's a tremendous amount of support and participation in the stakeholder communities to design this. This is a new opportunity that the federal government has presented us. It's the next, I like to refer to it as the next generation of PCA services. It's an improvement to what we currently are able to offer in Minnesota. It does provide not only assistance with daily living and health-related tasks and skills, but you can help people acquire skills. You can help people become more independent, which our current PCA program is not focused upon doing. One of the unique features of this program is that we are using an implementation council, which is comprised of at least 51% of either program participants or their family members. So that really is a consumer-designed model, so we can be even more targeted to what do people need to remain independent in the community. We're working with CMS. This is a very new program allowed from the federal government, and so they're also feeling their way through what are the opportunities, what are the constraints, what do we have to comply with. And so we have weekly calls with CMS to talk about our Reform 2020 initiatives, and we're making progress, but it still is a very tedious and detailed process to make sure that we know how we can design this program, satisfy the federal government, work within the resources that we have available, which is attractive because this comes with an additional 6% federal participation, which allows us to be even more creative on how we can help people remain independent. Still a lot of work to be done, a lot of great ideas coming from the Implementation Council, most of which have a dollar amount assigned to it, that we can't do all of those things, but we're trying to prioritize and make sure that we design the program as best as we can. I'm sure there could be others who would like to talk about this also.
And thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just had a question in regard to the CFSS program. And there is a provision in here which does state that that support workers shall not be a participant of CFSS. And I was wondering if you could explain why that provision is in there. It seems to me that these folks could provide very good quality support for people who are facing disabilities. Obviously, they're going through it themselves. They have the experience, and if they're in the CFSS program, they can pass along. It seems to me a lot of the knowledge and the experience that they're learning through that program to those that they're caring for. I guess question about whether that would be considered discriminatory not to allow them to participate in this program. So,
Mr. Coleman.
Madam Chair, Senator, it's a policy decision that if an individual needs supports of a PCA, then they're not as likely to be able to provide support or be a caregiver to another individual. There are varying opinions about this topic. This is where we have landed as a policy at this point in time. But there are alternative views of whether that should be allowed or not.
Senator Eakin.
Madam Chair, and there is a provision that already says if they're not capable of carrying out those responsibilities of being a support worker, that's already in there that they would not be allowed. So it seems to me that that would take care of it to have a wholesale exclusion of these individuals, some of whom will probably give the best quality care because they have the experience, they have the knowledge, and being a part of the CFS seems to me it'd provide them with a better base for providing those services.
Senator Lurie?
Madam Chair, maybe I can tip my hand a little bit. The author of this bill actually kind of agrees with you, Senator Eakin, and if this gets picked up off the table, it'll likely have a slight change on that, and we can continue to discuss it. You know, as we move forward.
Thank you, Senator Lurie.
You're welcome, Senator Eakin.
Mr. Coleman.
Okay, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm going to move down to item number 39, intensive services for children with autism spectrum disorder. Certainly a very actively debated topic last night, and let's try to talk a little bit about what the governor is proposing to do in this budget. There has been a lot of work going on this session on this topic, and what the proper role of the state and the private sector should be doing on providing services for kids with autism. Let me comment that in my judgment, if I'm allowed a judgment, we've not done our best work in this area. It has been very challenging, and even as we sit here today, there's more work to be done with family stakeholders, providers, managed care organizations, and certainly the committee. But we have learned that early intervention is the key to providing effective treatment. And the governor's proposal is trying to clarify what are the benefits available to children with autism, because there has been a lot of confusion. And so this is trying to really focus on the earliest intervention and treatment, and how can we make this investment in children, as you heard last night, to prevent the ongoing expense for a lifetime. We have not, within this budget proposal, we have not identified any single therapeutic approach. We're looking at the spectrum of approaches, including applied behavioral analysis, but not limited to that or excluding that. Most importantly, we want to monitor this program and see, by collecting the data of what is working, that we can improve this program going forward. And we don't have that database currently. So it's a significant investment, not suggesting that it is the end of the conversation about early intervention, but we want to be more open about what services are available to children in our communities and how to help them be more successful. There are some processes that we are recommending that we manage the program consistently for all children in our public programs, whether they're within managed care or within fee-for-service. It shouldn't matter. There was a tracking error in the first presentation that I shared with you. And so some of the, quote, caps that people want to refer to are not caps. They're estimations of what we think the program will be able to accommodate as we roll this forward. So it's individualized in terms of the number of hours of therapy or services that would be approved. And then it's not limited to a specific number of children, but it's, again, the fiscal note reflects the estimated ability for us to kind of ramp up services first year, second year, et cetera.
Senator Hayden has a question here.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Coleman. I'm glad to hear that, because that was a substantial part of the conversation yesterday and subsequent emails to me today, is that we were creating a two-tiered a system for those who have private insurance and those who are medical assistants, thus kind of perpetuating our disparities that we have, that we continue to talk about. So I just want to be clear that this is just kind of projection information, but no child would be capped no child that is receiving early intervention autism services that are on MA would necessarily be capped, would have a hard cap. They would be looked at in an individual basis and treatment monitored and all of those kinds of good prudent things, but there is no, if it is medically warranted and necessary, they would continue to get the treatment no matter what the cost. That's what I want to make sure that I hear you saying.
Mr. Coleman?
Madam Chair, Senator, the word capped gets used in so many different ways, so I want to kind of repeat what I heard so there's minimal confusion. Again, there are processes that we are proposing that would require an interdisciplinary plan, an authorization, and then a reauthorization based upon what has transpired during the previous 6 months, let's just say. And certainly we want to document what's working, then move forward. And if the treatment team believes something else should be tried because the current treatment plan hasn't been effective, then that should be a decision with the family and the child. But no, they would not be eliminated necessarily because of a fiscal or because of a financial restriction on the part of the state. We do have to, though, monitor to make sure that the dollars are being spent appropriately. And again, as I kind of said earlier, we will be back talking about this topic as we develop more data, more research to modify the program.
Senator Hayden. So Madam Chair,
Madam Mr. Chair, if we,
Senator Lurie.
If we could, we're going to have to get to the point where we open the we have at least eight testifiers that drove through the snow to get here today, and we do have session at 11, and so if we could allow the Mr. Coleman to finish up the presentation that he's going to do and take the testimony, I think that'd be the most respectful of everybody's time.
Absolutely.
I don't mean to be shutting down the conversation, but time management dictates that we press on. I'm sorry about that.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. When I saw you look at your watch, Senator Lurie, I thought you might say that, so
okay.
we should proceed.
Mr. Coleman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to then move to item 43. This is the rate increase and quality add-on for nursing facilities. The governor is proposing to provide a rate increase to nursing facilities. It's done in kind of a two-step. One is a increase for all nursing facilities in Minnesota equally, and then the other part of the increase is a pay for performance, a quality add-on that would be calculated based upon the current nursing facility report card. And that increase would range depending upon the quality score of the facility. That would be the first 2 years of the biennium. In the next 2 years, the proposal would be based fully on performance in the governor's budget. 45 and 46 are items that suspend the automatic increase in rates that is currently in law. And if you do the math, 45 and 46 should pretty much equal what is being spent in item 43. So we're suspending the mechanism that is in current law for an increase, and we're replacing it with a proposal to do both a base adjustment as well as a quality add-on. Okay. Okay, number 47 is similar but not identical. We do not have a mechanism to pay for performance on the home and community-based site for our disability providers, our elderly waiver providers, our ICFDDs. We do not have a pay-for-performance mechanism. Therefore, as I indicated earlier, we wish to develop a report card. We wish to have the conversation and develop what are the quality indicators, what are those elements that we want to incent quality, we want to measure. And so we've delayed the home and community-based pay-for-performance system for 2 years while we develop those measurements. And then in the out biennium, we would provide rate increases to the home community-based providers based upon those quality standards. Along the way, though, we provided a small amount of money, I'll admit it's small, to replicate the PIP program, a performance improvement program that we have on the nursing facility side, whereby providers come forward with their proposal to improve quality. It's selected by the provider. We negotiate how we're going to measure their improvement, and then we make a payment if they achieve those goals. So we have a limited amount of money. It would be on a competitive basis for the home and community-based side to come forward and self-select what aspect of life for their consumers they wish to improve, and we would negotiate the terms of those arrangements. So that's item number 47. Number 49, we need some additional flexibility in managing our disability waivers, and this provision would allow us to do so. We'd be able to move dollars more effectively from county to county based upon where the needs are greater. Those counties that may not need quite the amount of allocation that they have in their aggregate budget, we could perhaps shift to another part of the state that is demonstrating a greater need. So we're looking for some additional authorities to manage the disability waivers more effectively. Item 53, quality provider standards. Again, this is part of our compliance, our corrective action plan with CMS, where we are moving from a county-based system of contracting and standards to a statewide provider enrollment, rate methodology, and oversight. And so this is implementing standards statewide for our disability waivers to assure quality. Very part and parcel of the changes that we're making in our compliance plan. Lots of work groups, a lot of work going into this, and a lot of training. If you look at the budget items, there's a lot of training so that we can assure direct care providers, direct care workers, have the kind of training they need to meet the standards that we are setting for serving Minnesotans with disabilities. Item 55, the reporting of data from nursing facilities has become quite complex. There's been lots of changes over the last number of years, and we don't believe that there's any substantial intentional misreporting, but as we've moved towards making sure that, for example, Medicare is paying for services that they should be paying for and not Medicaid, as we look for our facilities reporting accurately on their data, on their billings and so forth, we think that there is room for improvement for us to audit and correct those practices that have just become in error through the many changes that have been made over the last number of years. So this is actually a savings part of the budget. It's not substantial, but we think we can help facilities report more accurately. Dropping down to the very bottom, you heard about disability waiver rate setting. I just comment one more time. it is an important part of the efforts that we're making to improve our system.
Any questions from members? Seeing none, we're going to go on with and take the testimony for this section from, I believe I have Wayne Lindholm listed and Diane Raff. We can start with them, and then we'll move forward.
I do have handles.
And I'll be calling testifiers in two, so we're ready. Once one is completed with their testimony, we can move forward with the next testifier.
I think she wants us both here.
Yeah. No, they just gotta roll.
Yep.
Please state your name for the record and proceed with testimony.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Wayne Lindholm. And I'm a parent of a guardian of a 27-year-old daughter born with developmental disabilities, now living in an adult foster care home in Minnesota. And I do have three handouts that are being passed out. I was asked to provide some supporting material. The first one is a report from the Ombudsman's Office that was just tallied January 14th, showing abuse, neglect, serious injury, and deaths. The next one is an article from the Star Tribune just 6 days ago, hundreds of abuse cases await state action. And then finally, an article from a little over 10 years ago where we highlighted a section here where our licensing director, Jerry Kerber, was quoted as saying that that we don't do a good job of looking at the forest, licensing director Jerry Kerber said in June. For example, the department should consider whether training and overall competency standards for care workers is adequate. And that's what I wish to speak to today. I appreciate the opportunity to provide you with a parent guardian view of the adult foster care in Minnesota, specifically the continuing care section of Senate File 1034. This committee plays an important role in the safety and quality of care of our most vulnerable people in the state of Minnesota. I have concerns in the area of safety. Within a year of moving into an adult foster care residence, our daughter, along with her housemates, suffered the unthinkable. Their day program van driver, believing the residential staff for the house was present, dropped off the residence at the house. Unfortunately, the residential staff was not present. It was fall, the weather was 50 degrees, a light drizzle was coming down. Unable to enter the home, these vulnerable adult ladies sat on the front step of their home. They were locked out and not discovered until the overnight staff arrived 8 hours later. Needless to say, they were chilled to the bone, wet, frightened with the uncertainty of the situation. Fortunately, in our case, these ladies stayed together and avoided what could have been a much more unfortunate outcome. I commend the efforts of the Minnesota Department of Human Services to continuously improve the design and oversight of adult foster care homes. However, much work remains to be done. At a minimum, staying on top of all aspects of health, safety, and environmental systems requires ongoing training and education for residential staff. When budgets are stretched thin, as they always are, it is not the time to reduce or eliminate the requirement for annual training and education of residential staff. Quality suffers, which drives up costs. The residential staff are the people on the front line of care for our state's most vulnerable people and the ones best positioned to impact the quality of care that our vulnerable adults receive, thereby impacting costs up or down in the very area where costs are highest, staffing. In other words, those individuals closest to the work are the most able to improve the work if the training and education and support to positively change the system is there. We all know our track record of maltreatment in vulnerable adults in the state of Minnesota. It is not improving, and some present a case it is getting worse. However, we can positively impact this by focusing on quality and not reducing or eliminating ongoing annual training and education hour requirements. As a parent and guardian of one of our state's vulnerable adults, I ask you in the strongest way to not back away from allocating resources and regulatory oversight for our most vulnerable adults. Thanks for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Lindholm.
Ms. Raff, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, Senators, I'm Diane Raff. I'm the Executive Director of the Living at Home Network. We are the network of Minnesota's Living at Home Block Nurse programs that serve seniors, caregivers, and our communities throughout the state. And I am here to stand behind the provisions that you find, item 29, the critical access study and services, in particular the core home and community-based services grants to nonprofits. And we just want to make it very clear that we do stand behind this, and we would like to see it proceed without any amendments. We thank you for your many years of support for the Living at Home Block Nurse programs. I think many of you know the dynamic work that we do in our communities. And we see this change as actually something very exciting to open up the funding so that we can support more programs, not just our own, but also those affiliated with Faith in Action and some of the other non-affiliated programs. You'll hear from my colleague from Faith in Action in a few minutes, and we stand together on this. Just to remind you that this is really not a cost driver. It's actually a cost-saving piece. The state share for an annual nursing home cost for a single medical assistance recipient is calculated at about $44,000. And when you divide the $1.5 million allocation in the governor's budget, it comes out to basically 34. And 34, us helping keep 34 frail, low-income seniors living at home successfully where they want to be rather than having to enter a nursing home prematurely. And last year, just our programs, which is actually about 40% of the programs that would be eligible for future funding, our programs served over 5,000 of these frail seniors. So you can see that the cost savings is there. And so if we fully support this, we're part of that effort to get ahead of the wave of seniors and control costs while improving the quality of life for our seniors. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Raff. Yeah. Senator Claussen.
Thank you. I have a question for our first testifier.
Yes.
Earlier, just a few minutes ago, we heard about a common entry point.
Mr. Lindholm, you would have to go back to the table, please. Thank you. Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Earlier, we just heard a report about a proposal for a common entry point that would be available across the state for reporting suspected abuse. As you presented your information, I didn't hear you speak to reporting, but more about training oversight issues. And I'm just curious about your perspective on the issue of reporting of incidents.
Right.
Mr. Lindholm.
Thank you, Senator. The training comments I made were because the 40-hour training requirement's been removed, and we're asking that it not be. As far as the common entry point, I think collecting better data is the first step in any quality system. And as a parent and a person that works in quality systems in my professional life, anything that would improve the quality of reporting, I think, is a first step of really getting a handle around on that. And I would trust that the Department of Human Services, if a common entry point is beneficial to them, and I would support that. But that's the extent that I know about it.
Thank you.
And Senator Sharon?
Yes. We have an amendment that's been presented to the committee to change, not to go back to the 40 hours, but to have some modification so that that's not completely removed in terms of to 26 hours and then requiring certain functions to make certain 26 hours of pre-service training occur so that you prevent the problem that the person is, that
right.
The public is assured that they're trained ahead of time and is responsive to the messages that were in the articles that you presented here. So that amendment will be discussed later, as Senator Laurie indicated. So I want you to know, if you weren't here for that hearing, that there is a proposal.
Thank you, Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Mr. Lindholm.
There's the amendment. Mine, you copied. You can read it for a minute, but bring it back.
Thank you.
Thank you. We will now ask Steve Larson from ARC and Wayne Lindholm. Oh, we have twice your name here. So Jeff Fromm from Faith in Action. You both can proceed. Proceed to the table so we can hear your testimony if you're still here or...
Yeah, I don't see Steve Larson, but...
Jeff? Mr. Frome, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning with you. I came down from central Minnesota, and I'm here, so they're working on the roads. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Frome, and I am the chair of the Minnesota Faith in Action Board of Directors. I come here on behalf of the thousands of Minnesotans that are being served throughout the state with home and community-based services. I'm here to really support the work that has been done, lots of work that has gone into restructuring the home and community-based services by the department, and to really support those efforts. Specifically, I address, I think it's item 29, referring to the home and community-based services. For several decades now, home and community-based providers like Faith in Action programs throughout the state have been delivering quality services that have been helping thousands of older adults remain in their homes. We focus on connecting the older adults with identifying their challenges early on and then providing trained, competent volunteers, cost-effective volunteers to assist them, neighborly volunteers. This most often happens before they become even eligible for public programs and often will delay more costly nursing home admissions and medical interventions. Last year alone, this is just our volunteer driver program. We provided over 70,000 rides, driving over 110,000 miles throughout the state to essential supports like doctor's appointments, grocery shopping, other essential rides. That's just one of the services we provide. If you live nearby or in a community that has a program like ours, you probably know someone who has been helped by one of our volunteers. The problem may be that if you have not heard about us, maybe yours is a community that lacks this kind of service available in your community. The Reform 2020 proposal that is before you increases the funding that expands the number of organizations, at least the possibility of that, that of organizations present throughout the community to help our older adults and adults with disabilities. This support can also help to establish programs that are already established will help them to strengthen them, their infrastructure to better handle the demographic, as we know, the aging population, and also encourage sustainability. Certainly this funding doesn't totally support our programs. It's an encouragement and leverages additional funding. One example of the programs that's increasing throughout the state among the Faith in Action is support for family caregivers. The one-on-one support that we provide, the consultation, the in-home respite to give those caregivers a break is really essential in terms of going down the road in the future. The DHS proposal, I think the estimate was 1%. A 1% decrease in family caregiving due to burnout or for whatever reason will really cost the state an additional $30 million to the budget. I think we want to support the family caregivers. The reform proposal maintains current funding for caregiver support and for respite programs. Our programs do not want to sit back and have the state completely fund our programs. This isn't our intent at all. We are all independent, not-for-profit organizations funded primarily by local support from local persons served and local stakeholders. People want to take care of their own. It's important that we're supported primarily from our local people. We don't ever want to become dependent heavily on outside funds. However, paying for often part-time staff and for basic office essentials to keep functioning to train those volunteers has become a challenge for many of our programs. And the needs and, of course, the level of services are increasing. We know that. The services we provide have a lasting effect not only on the persons we serve, but it's really about community building. It keeps our communities together, helping them to learn and have the skills and capacity to support each other in the local communities. It's building our whole communities around the state. The state has provided some support for many of our programs for a number of years through a variety of funding streams, including the Community Service Development Grants. This would be a consistent resource for us to be able to maintain a core level of services, drawing on primarily on additional resources in our community. The legislation is important. Without full funding as requested, though, it will not provide our moms and dads and grandmas and grandpas with the support that they need. So once again, we strongly recommend the adoption and full funding of the proposal as suggested in the governor's budget. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Fromm, and thank you for your service.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
At this point, Galen Smith is next on the list. I also have Alice Hulbert, which I know was here earlier, but I'm not sure if she's still. She's, okay. Is there any other testifiers from the audience at this point? Seeing none, Senator Lurie?
Well, you know, having 15 minutes to work with, maybe we can entertain some amendments and see if we can make some progress on that.
Senator Scherer?
Evidently not as many people did traverse the snow as I had been led to believe.
I Senator can pull A8 from the table if that's acceptable to the committee. And I know that Senator Eakin had an amendment, so I hope he's coming back.
We will have the A8 amendment passed to the remaining members here.
Don't you guys, somebody want to, you guys maybe want to.
I believe the agency was here yesterday and heard what the A8 amendment was about. But, Senator Sharon, can you just briefly elaborate?
Just very quickly, remember the testimony from Alice
Hulbert.
Dr. Alice Hulbert about her experiences with her family, and then today's testimony about the desire to not have the full 40 hours be removed as an obligation for training. And this amendment would reestablish a 26-hour orientation training component, and
Senator Lurie?
Madam Chair, I know you may have some insights into this as well. I know DHS is here and has looked over it too. Maybe they can help describe it and give their thoughts about what it is and some of the background. I know we had some initial discussions on it, and maybe if we don't have the right people in the room, it's not the right time to move an actual amendment, and we could have, you know, I know members did have some questions of DHS. I defer to the chair as to the best use
sure.
of these last.
Senator Lurie, this came up yesterday, so that I believe DHS is well aware of the amendment,
right.
So ready to hopefully respond to it. And I know they had some concerns, and the amendment stems from some of our constituents that have voiced the concerns that we heard from a previous testifier of removing the 40-hour training. And this amendment deals with that, provides for a minimum of 24 hours, and it also allows some of the competency and training evaluations a list of what they must include so that we are ensured that we are protecting our most vulnerable and adults in the foster care system. So with that, I'd like to open it up for, I believe, DHS here and testifier. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Alex Bartolik, and I'm with the Department of Human Services. Just to set a context, part of the waiver provider standards that we are doing and that have come before you is a look at our entire home and community-based service system. So when you talk about foster care or all of our home and community-based services, there have been different standards across the different waivers. So it's true that we had one licensing standard primarily for services for people with developmental disabilities, but we also had people being served under different waiver programs that did not have those standards. So when we looked at what standards do we want across all services, we were trying to look at what are basic assurances that any provider should do. What are basic health and safety protections? How do you make sure that people's any money or any funds are taken care of, any health conditions are taken care of? So there's some basic protections that every provider has to do. They have to have policies on. They have to train their staff on. And then there's more intensive services, which include what many people are thinking of right now as foster care, but where you're caring for a person. It might be in a person's home, somebody going in, as well as in foster care, but it's doing more training or rehabilitation. It's helping a person to a greater extent. Not only do they have to meet the basic assurances, but we have to figure out what are the standards for all those staff. And what we had done in looking at our stakeholders is while the previous rule for DD had a certain number of hours of training, there were a lot of concerns about, well, what did that mean? Were staff really competent and able to do the services? And how can we structure something that is really going to get at the heart of what's important for well-trained staff? And so there were some hours of training, but more there are areas of competencies that people are expected to demonstrate. Some of these are general competencies, and many of the things that are in this amendment are in different parts of 245D. It might not be in a list in the orientation, but it is in different sections of the proposed statute and standards. But it was a focus on competencies with the assumption that for people to be competent, you're going to have to train, you're going to have to provide some oversight, you're going to have to know what to do if something isn't going well. So we don't have an issue with training at all. I think it was trying to look at when you bring together services for 37,000 people, many of which were governed by different licensing standards and many of which were unlicensed. How do you come up with a set of standards that can fit across that? There might be some technical assistance in here. We would, our first reaction with having things be under the direction of a registered nurse is this is something that's typically more in a home care service. That is a different license standard that does go on. So when we're talking about nursing and delegation and having that oversight, when people need that, the provider should have a home care license, and they should be providing that kind of nursing and other support through that license. But under our home and community-based services, if the intent is making sure that the training is correct, that somebody's made sure that the curriculum is something that will fit and is appropriate, there might be a different way of doing it. There would be a cost if we were to require it to be under the direction of a registered nurse, and also it might run into some issues about what's licensed under DHS versus MDH. There's some technical assistance on the last clause on 1.22 about the 24-hour care with corporate supervision. We might be able to just identify what provider we're actually talking about or what service a little bit more clearly the way the standards go. So that's an area of technical assistance. I do want to point out that this issue of training and really making sure our providers are competent, we know what's going on, and more than anything, everybody, families and providers can make improvements and be able to talk through it. There's a number of provisions in more of the administrative section of the provider standards in the bill that you just heard. For example, we are asking for funding to provide all providers across Minnesota with free access to an online curriculum called the College of Direct Supports. It has a wide number of training curriculums. Many states are requiring this for all of their direct care staff. It's huge. It can be your basic training. It can be more detailed. It can talk about what to do if you're dealing with people who have challenging behaviors, to what to do if you're dealing with people with more medical needs. basic assurances. So this is an important resource that we know that if providers have to pay for training, it's going to be expensive and it might be inconsistent. So we want to make sure everybody has access to this College of Direct Support. We also have put in resources to be able to do remediation, to take the data from the Ombudsman's Office, from licensing, from all these incidents, do analysis, use a stakeholder group to help us identify trends and pinpoint those areas as a state we want to focus on. And it could be regionally, it could be statewide, and to be able to get involved in that. Also to just do technical assistance. We know that our counties will see things that might not be a licensing violation, might not be maltreatment, but they're just wondering about it, and how do we work with them to start doing more quality improvement at the very early signs? So there's a number of things that I think are important to really build a quality system. Training is part of it, and there are different ways of providing it, but also to know that the bill that you just heard does have some components to try to really monitor and target efforts effectively to improve quality.
Thank you, Ms. Bartolik. I'll just start with some questions, and I'm sure Senator Sharon might have some others. What I just heard was great in theory, but particular to this amendment, is there anything there? I mean, you said that there are some components in the bill. I appreciate to know where they are specifically. How can we tackle and make sure that the training piece that we're concerned about with this amendment is actually addressed?
Sure.
And it's actually doable, because it's fine if we have access to training supporting material, but it's not the same thing as requiring it. And I think as DHS and MH and Department of Health as well, you're required to have these licenses and you're the authority to mm-hmm. provide these licenses, and they should have an expectation that these licenses require certain expectations of training and they should be heightened. And I'm not aware where they're at, so I'd like your assistance on making sure that is included in this bill. It's one of my top priorities for some of my constituents that made this a very, very important issue for them. So you talked a lot about various things. I just don't feel comfortable that we're really addressing what's part of this amendment. So I'd like to work with you on making sure mm-hmm. that this bill addresses these concerns and are very, very clear of what they are. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I am also aware in the bill of the initiatives and the concern the department has about training, and I think that what is proposed here is complementary to that and strengthens that. I hope you're not suggesting that this would be an opposition to what it is that you're doing. It certainly elevates it and focuses more on what the consumer is asking for protections. I would like to see us continue to move this forward and complement with what it is, and particularly this remediation effort, and also the College of Direct Supports. It's a fabulous resource for people to meet what is required in this legislation. I would also accept the technical offer for technical assistance on the section of 1.6 where you're raising that there may be concerns about how the language is written as a supervision from a registered nurse, how to accomplish what the intent is there, but to have that written in a way that doesn't create the complexities you've described. Mm-hmm. And also in the last paragraph, there was some technical language change that you thought should occur if we move this mm-hmm. forward. I'd like to see that so that we can be responsive to Senator Franzen's constituent who has brought this forward. So with that, I would just indicate that I would request that information, because I think this is complementary to what you've mm-hmm. described, but also comes from not just on our first day when we introduced this, but today again in a separate situation. They weren't working in collaboration with each other, a request for not simply eliminating that 40-hour training requirement.
And Ms. Bartolik, before I let you respond, I know that Ms. Hulbert, who was not here and testified yesterday, she also is part of the State Quality Council, so she has been part of those stakeholder meetings and still has this concern. So obviously we still have to work on this. Ms. Bartolik.
Madam Chair, we'll be happy to give you a side-by-side. We can show you for these areas what's in the bill and then you can make decisions about whether you think you need to add, and we will provide technical assistance in these other areas. Training is important, and I think that when you merge a lot of different standards together and try to find a way to proceed, one of the questions will be, how do we define competence, and how do we really talk about not just training, but how do you use experience to assure that people are doing what you want them to do, and we'd be happy to work with you.
Senator Sharon?
I would just confirm. I think competence is the goal.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And this doesn't speak to competence, but whatever you're doing in complement to this to get after that issue, I think that's a great complement to what both of these initiatives are about.
Senator Lurie?
Well, I'm encouraged by the conversation. I think that with the technical assistance, I mean, and I think we can all agree that competency is actually the ultimate goal. I mean, training for training's sake is not the ultimate goal. We want to make sure that staff providing direct care to vulnerable populations is competent to provide that care safely. And so maybe with the technical assistance and the side-by-side, we can make significant progress to complement what's in the bill today and make sure that it meets the needs of the advocates and the parents and the families of these vulnerable populations. And with that, I think we're pretty much out of time. Opening up another topic would probably be unwise.
Should I put this back on the table for us to bring it back up later then when we have the
technical assistance? I didn't hear you actually offer the AA, did you?
I pulled it from the table, whatever that means.
I don't know. I didn't know what that meant.
Oh.
So.
I thought Senator Sharon offered it the other day, so then I tabled the motion.
So, Senator Sharon, if I may, I suggest that we can certainly vote on it, put it in the bill, and work on it with the agency to make sure that we get this done.
That we can improve the language later. That'd be fine with me. I'll offer the eight amendment.
Senator Sharon offers the eight amendment. I think we've exhausted the discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. And I, like Senator Lurie mentioned, I think we're pretty close to the time to session. So we will adjourn.
I'll lay Senate File 1034 on the table. And
great. Thank you, Senator Lurie. We're adjourned.
It'll be all right.